Be turning, if you will, to Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27, we started the chapter last week. The Apostle Paul was sent to Rome by way of a merchant ship with Julius, the centurion, and 100 of his soldiers, most likely, all of those that were under his command. There were also other prisoners on the ship, and we learned that Aristarchus of Thessalonica was also on that ship, traveling with Paul, and one more. Luke, the author, he's not named, but by the use of us and we see that Luke is also with them. Again, it's a commercial vessel that they are on, and we saw from the map last time that they sailed to Sidon, where Paul was treated kindly by Julius and was allowed to go visit friends for that evening and go refresh himself. And then the next day they left Sidon, and because of the winds not being favorable for open sailing, they sailed over Cyprus, hugging the coastline of Cilicia, Pamphylia, Lycia. And so we see we got Sidon and sailing under Cilicia and Pamphylia and Lycia, and then they land at Myra, and there they switch from one commercial sailing vessel to a different commercial sailing vessel, and from there they drop south to sail down under Crete. Again, it's not the straightest route so far, but they're working with the winds of the season, and they finally end up at Fair Havens. The journey had gone very slowly, taking many days with much difficulty. Those are the exact words that we read, so we get an idea of how unfavorable those winds were. They had anticipated this trip to go much quicker than it had so far. And the longer it takes them to sail to Rome, the more treacherous this journey is going to become just because of the season. It's late September or early October. We read because it was the time of fasting. The time of fasting on the Jews' calendar is the Day of Atonement. You may see that on your calendar sometimes. Yom Kippur as a holiday. And maybe you've pulled that up and said, "What? Oh, it says today's a holiday." And you look and it says Yom Kippur. And you say, "That must be some Jewish holiday." It is. It's the Day of Atonement. Sailing would now be dangerous anywhere on the Mediterranean because of the autumn storms that would blow up. So Paul warns them after they're at Fair Havens that they need to stay right there. That if they continue any further, they could lose the cargo, the ship, or even their lives could be lost. So he proposes just to stay put there for the winter. But Julius listens to the captain of the ship and the owner of the ship, and they decide to sail around to the port of Phoenix and winter there. Doesn't look like it's that far from Fair Havens. Around there to where Phoenix is, where you see the two points coming up in that area, they decided that would be a much better place to stay for the winter. Not long after they set sail, though, I mean, the winds looked favorable, the sky was clear, and they decide to set sail. But not long after they set sail, a storm came up out of nowhere, and the strong wind from the east pushes them out into the open sea. They fought it at first, hoping that the storm would pass quickly, but it does not. And it's a terrible storm. The sailors are afraid the ship might break apart, so they gird it around and underneath with cables for extra strength to hold the ship together. And they pull the sails, allowing the wind to just drive them where it will. I believe a whole lot of that took place in one day. One long, weary day. The storm continues to rage around them, and the ship continues to take on water. So they try to make the ship ride higher in the water by throwing all the cargo overboard. That didn't accomplish all that they wanted. So then the next day, they started throwing all the rigging off of the ship. Anything about the ship that they did not absolutely need to run this ship, they throw it overboard. We recall that that's exactly what Paul would say could happen if they did not stay where they were, that they would lose the cargo, costing them money, and also the ship. And this is just the beginning of it, of the loss of the ship, and the very possibly even their lives. That was back up at verse 10 of chapter 27. So this is where we pick up today. Verse 20, let's read that. Acts chapter 27 and verse 20. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Day after day, the storm continues to batter the ship that they're on, and now they feared that, you know, their lives would be next. It appears that this includes Luke himself, because if you look at it again, at the end of the verse, he says, all hope that we should be saved was finally given up. Luke begins to wonder if he also will lose his life on this voyage, it appears. And again, this is where we pick up today. That's where we left off last night. Not last night, last time. Up to this point in the journey, Julius has pretty much been in charge. That is the centurion, the Roman soldier, who's over these 100 soldiers and watching over the prisoners and taking them to Rome. He and the captain and the owner of the ship, of course, are involved in those decisions. I got some kind of jumble in my notes there. You ever do that? Like your fingers, your brain runs faster than your fingers and you just can't keep up. I do that texting a lot too. But you know, they didn't ask Paul about what to do here at this point. I mean, Paul had told them not to leave Fair Havens, but they did. And it appears that when they decided to, Paul didn't argue with them. We have no record that he did. But would it have done any good if he did? Probably not. I mean, he had already given his advice and they didn't listen to it. So then when this happens, you know, they don't go to Paul here. We wouldn't expect that they would. I mean, after all, he's just a prisoner who's a Jew. But after a long absence, keeping to himself, Paul does appear and give them a message. Look at verse 21. But after a long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. What does it sound like Paul is saying? I told you so. I don't think that was Paul's tone, though. Not really. I mean, how well would that go over if your first thing out of your mouth after all this happens is a phrase of confrontation? So, you know, maybe you know some people that are like that. Maybe very close friends or family members or maybe somebody in your house. But, you know, moving on. I just don't think that. Oh, she's not even here. I'm picking on her. She's ill. Paul wasn't that kind of person. So if it wasn't in that tone, then what is Paul doing? You know, tone of voice goes a long way, doesn't it? So I don't think Paul said it in a tone of voice as though, see, I told you so. So what do you think Paul is doing? Yeah, he's going to get to the point where he's offering guidance now, a solution. So I think he did it more in a way of establishing credibility. Now, and again, tone. We don't get the tone, you see, of what Paul said. We just get the words. But I think he probably spoke it in a very soft tone, a very tender tone to the people. He's establishing credibility here, not only for himself, but more so as an apostle of the Lord, as a prophet of God. You know, I received these words, I think is what he's saying. But you didn't listen to me then. Hopefully you'll listen to me now. And the point being that Paul can take over now in a position of leadership in this voyage, because he didn't have that. They didn't listen to him. And he's hoping to insert himself now in that kind of position and demonstrate that the one he serves is the true and living God. Verse 22. Paul says, and now I urge you to take heart. Take heart, it says in the New King James. What does it say in the King James? Be of good cheer. Take heart. Be of good cheer, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. take heart, be of good cheer, be encouraged, because none of us are going to die. However, the ship is going to be destroyed. Well, what do you think about that? Stop and think about this logically for a moment. Are they pulling another ship alongside them that they can just step over onto the other ship? None of us are going to die. However, this ship is going to be destroyed. Ken?
Are these sailors or the people with this
right. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we hadn't gotten there yet. No. Yes. It's on this journey. It comes later. But yeah, you're absolutely right. They haven't seen Paul do anything miraculous at this point. Yeah, he's just a mouthy prisoner at this point. I love it, Ken. That's good. So you're on this ship that's being battered in the storm, and the guy says, this ship is going to be destroyed, but none of us are going to die. Does that sound logical? It doesn't. It doesn't sound logical. So I wonder how much they really believe what he has to say here. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind when Paul does this and comes out and says, the ship's going to be destroyed, but we're all going to live. And the first thing that comes to my mind is, inconceivable. Anybody know that movie? Inconceivable. How could Paul make such a promise? Let's look at verses 23 and 24. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. A messenger of God appeared to him, see, and gave him this promise. An angel. The Romans worshiped many gods. They were polytheistic, is the term for it. That there were a whole bunch of gods that they worshiped. But Paul says, I speak on behalf of the one true God, the one that I serve. God had promised that Paul must go and stand before Caesar, and so God promised that his life would be saved in this storm. He'd be spared in this storm. And not only him, but everyone sailing with him would be spared in this storm.
You know what he didn't say, but what I would think would be, we're going to get wet.
Yeah, that could be. Seems to be the only way that they could survive if this happened, if the ship is going to be destroyed. Look what it says, though, there in verse 24. Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed, God has granted who? You. What does that say about Paul? What was Paul doing? Praying. Paul had obviously been praying for these people. Because the angel said, God has granted you, or given thee, all that sail with thee, or with you. Now that was something that was spoken to Paul, so it appears to be an answer to a request that Paul had made, namely that no one would die on this voyage. And again, that tells us a lot about not only Paul's prayer life, but what our prayer life should be like. By all rights, most of these people, or at least half of them, are enemies of Paul. And we're going to see that come out here in just a bit. But he was not only praying for himself and his friends and his faithful traveling companions, but he was even praying for the safety of those who weren't Christians, who weren't believers. I mean, Paul knows that by and large, if they all die, the ship goes down and they all drown, how many of them are going to be believers at that point? Not very many. I mean, maybe, you know, like five or something. Paul wants an opportunity. He knows that's what would happen to them. Most of them are going to hell if they die right now. Paul wants an opportunity to give them testimony, to witness to them, to present the gospel so that they can have an opportunity to be saved. And I think that was probably Paul's motivation in asking that they be spared so they can have an opportunity to present Christ to them. Verse 25. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. Again, take heart, be of good cheer, be encouraged. Paul completely trusted in God to perform what he said he would do. And listen, you know what? We serve that same God that Paul served. And he will fulfill the promises that he has made to us. We can have complete confidence in that, no matter what it looks like around us. If it's a raging storm around us that looks like we may even lose our life, we can still take heart, be encouraged, because we're in God's hands and he will fulfill every promise he has made to us. It's difficult to keep that in mind, isn't it? It's difficult to walk by faith and not by sight. Even I struggle with that, folks. I'm the pastor preaching the word up here, but you know, I say it often, and I'm going to say it many more times in the future. I preach to myself as I'm studying this passage, and I hope you get something out of it too as we look at this together. I'm not perfect. I'm not sinless by no means. We look at our circumstances around us and we think, this is dire. That's our first reaction. But we need to remember the God that we serve, that somehow all of this works out for good. It may not feel good at the time, but God didn't promise that. We have to walk by faith and not by sight. I'm so thankful for growing up here in this church and being taught the Word of God at a very early age. And one of the very first passages of Scripture I memorized was what, Cindy? The song, Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and what? He shall direct your path. God promises to direct our path, but He didn't promise that that path is going to always be easy. Sometimes we need encouragement. Sometimes we need someone to come along beside us and say, take heart. Be of good cheer. Be encouraged. Just as Paul offers them here. As brothers and sisters in Christ, that's part of our job. When we see somebody going through a difficult time, to come along beside them and just encourage them. Just stand with them for a time. But guess what? There's some bad news here as well. Verse 26. However, we must run aground on a certain island. Yes. By the way, did you notice the words here? Did he say this might happen? Look at the word. What is the four-letter word that he uses? Must. We must run aground first. Isn't that weird? We're all going to be saved, but the ship's going to be destroyed because we must run aground. It must happen. Again, we don't know all the ins and outs of things. We don't have all the facts. Too many times, I said this in the men's prayer breakfast yesterday, too many times in our life, we try to make things make sense. Because we want everything to make sense, and we want to be in control of all of it. But sometimes, you know, from this side of glory, it's not going to be that way sometimes. We can't make it make sense. That's not our job. Our job is to be faithful, to press forward no matter what happens and no matter what other people might think about it. We don't get the reaction of the people here that Paul is addressing. The narrative moves forward, you know, to the next thing in the next verse. The last we saw, though, was about them, was back up in verse 20, where they're all in despair and they pretty much believe they're going to die on this journey. All hope of living through this was lost. But Paul tries to encourage them. I'm not sure that it really took root, though, at this point. What do they see? Paul's speaking words, but do the words really mean anything right now? No, not to them, because what do they see?
Storm.
Yeah, they're not walking by faith, they're walking by sight. They see their circumstances right now, that they're stuck in this furious storm and the ship is just barely holding together right now. The storm hasn't let up. Again, they're looking at their circumstances. And human reason tells them that what Paul is saying doesn't make sense. But again, that's human reason. Verse 27. Now when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. How long? 14 nights now. And this started on the day that they went, so probably 14 days with the 14 nights. How long is that?
2 weeks.
I mean, it's one thing to put it in days, and that kind of sounds like a long time, but then, I mean, you put it in that phrase of, you know, 2 weeks. Can you imagine? The storm has not let up for 2 solid weeks. They've been tossed back and forth. Listen, I get seasick real easy. I cannot fathom being lost at sea in a raging storm, being tossed about with all the waves for 2 weeks. And what was happening during that time? Look closely again. It says, after the 14th night had come, and we were what?
Driven
up and down as they were blown across the sea. Now, if you look at our map over here, where they sailed off from Fair Havens and they meant to go around Crete and they got blown out to sea, it kind of looks like a sweeping line or straight line that runs over to the island labeled Malta right now. But that's not the case. In this fury of this tempest that's out here, that there should be a squiggly line that finally gets them to Malta. Because they're not just driven across the sea, they're driven up and down also as they're blown across the sea. It's not a straight line. Again, that's how it works in our life, isn't it? We can make all the plans we want to make and we think we would like to go from point A to point B to get there, but how many times does it work out that way? Probably very few. We make the plan and God laughs at us. A whole lot of times, if not most of the time, it's more like this. You know, we finally get to point B, but there's a whole lot of diversions. Anybody ever read The Family Circus? Back when there were newspapers and, you know, and there was a comic section and there'd be The Family Circus and a boy would be sent to take something next door. And then they'd show in the next panel where he went. Is all over the neighborhood before he arrives next door. That's kind of like it is in our life. There's a squiggled line instead of a straight line. How did they realize that they were drawing near land? This is verse 27. They sensed that they were drawing near land. How would they know that? Checking the depth, most likely. Now, as they were sailing, they would take soundings, is what it's called, to find out how deep the water is. It was just a long rope that had marks on it and a weight at the end. So that they could cast that overboard, and, you know, if you got to the end of the rope and it's still no bottom, it's pretty deep. But they had no idea where they were at sea. So I'm sure they were taking these soundings regularly to try to see if there's land anywhere nearby, and at some point that weight hit bottom. They're like, we must be getting close to land somewhere. So the shallower it gets, the closer they get then. Look at verse 28. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. Now, 20 fathoms is about 120 feet of water. A fathom is about 6 feet. So 120 feet of water at one point. And then they sounded again a little bit later, and it was 15 fathoms, 90 feet of water at this point. So we've gone 120 feet to 90 feet. So what does that tell you? It's getting shallower. We're getting closer to land. Again, they have no idea where they are. They can't see very far because of the storm. And so what are they afraid of now? They might run aground. But wait, isn't that what Paul said? We must run aground? But they take action. Verse 29. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. The stern, the back of the ship. They were hoping to keep the ship from crashing into the land. Maybe it'd be a rocky shore. They hoped that the ship would hold together until daylight. They prayed for daylight, hoping the ship wouldn't be destroyed before then. Because in daylight, maybe they can look around, see what the area looks like, formulate some kind of plan as to how they can safely get ashore to whatever landmass this is that they have come to. Verse 30. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff or the lifeboat into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow. I'm going to stop right there for a moment. The sailors are doing what? Fleeing. What's another term for that when you're on a ship? Abandoning ship. That's what they're doing. They pretend that they're going to let down the lifeboat and get in it and go put out some anchors in the front. But their intent is they're abandoning ship. They're terrified. Listen, when the sailors, seasoned sailors, are terrified, that tells you this is a very serious situation here. I mean, they're anchored out back. The ship, though, is still being battered by the storm. And they're afraid that at any moment the ship could just break apart and they'll lose their lives. What do you think would have happened, though, if they got in this lifeboat in this kind of storm? I mean, you're afraid the ship might not make it. What do you think will happen to a little lifeboat? I don't think they would have made it. You know, they're just so afraid right now. They're not thinking clearly. So Paul steps in, and Paul saves their life. Verse 31. Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." If these men go out in the ship, what's going to happen? In this lifeboat, they're going to die because of the storm. But is that all? Yeah. I mean, it's weird, but Paul knew exactly what was happening. He warns Julius, the centurion, what their intention is. But Paul gives some strange wording in the warning. Verse 31. Unless these men stay in the ship, what? You cannot be saved. You, to the centurion and to his soldiers, you won't be saved. If they leave the ship, you're all going to die. Not Paul, you see. He already had a promise from the Lord, but he said, if they leave, you're going to die. Verse 32. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes off the skiff, the lifeboat, and let it fall off. The soldiers cut the lines for the lifeboat. Nobody is getting off of this ship now, at least not in that way. Not by jumping on the lifeboat. Yeah, it does kind of seem that way, right? They listened to Paul, and they cut the ropes to the lifeboat and let it drift off. Verse 33. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, "Today is the 14th day. You've waited and continued without food and eaten nothing." Paul begged them to eat, which implies what? Yeah, it implies they've not been eating. Paul begs them to eat, which implies that they had not been eating. But wait, didn't Paul say several days ago they were going to survive? Yeah. Do you think they believed him? Not so much. It doesn't appear that way. Again, to them, it didn't make any sense. But not eating. I just got to pause there for a minute. 14 days. How many of you have ever gone 14 days without eating? Oh, that is true. Wow. 14 days. I can't even imagine that. I'm just going to be honest with you. They weren't eating because, you know, they're in severe distress emotionally, not hungry, and because they probably all still think that they're going to die. The longest I think of, what's that? Yeah. Yeah. No, they were taking in fluid. They're just not eating very much. I think the longest I've ever gone without food was 3 days. But again, Dorma, that wasn't by choice, was it? My 3 days wasn't by choice either. I mean, you know, by choice, I go like 6-7 hours and I think I'm going to die, right? But what happens to your body when you don't eat? Yeah, you start to lose energy. And so that's a problem. Verse 34. Paul said, "Therefore I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall off of the head of any of you." You need to eat. You're going to need your strength, Paul says, for what lies ahead, but none of you will be harmed. Verse 35. "And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, and when he had broken it, he began to eat." Paul gave thanks to who? God. In the presence of who? Idol worshippers. Another little aside from the men's prayer breakfast yesterday. When is it okay to say, "I don't care"? That's so ingrained in us not to do that. You know, from a young child, you don't say, "I don't care." Paul was offending people here, I'm sure, by praying to God in front of these idol worshipers that were most likely offended. What was Paul's attitude? "I don't care." We're called to be witnesses for Jesus Christ. We're called to be ambassadors of Jesus Christ. We can't do that very well if we're always concerned about what other people think. If we're always concerned about being liked. If we're always concerned about fitting in, if we're always concerned about offending people with our beliefs. Paul encouraged them with words, and now by example, he himself started eating in front of them, and it worked. Verse 36. "Then they were all encouraged and also took food themselves. And in all, we were 266 persons on the ship." 216, right? Is that what it says? 276. A score is 20, so 260. That's 60. 260 and 16 would be 76. Did I misread the verse here? Yeah, 76. 276 persons on the ship. 276 people on a ship. It's hard for us to imagine that kind of ship back then, isn't it? I mean, it's a sailing vessel. It's not a big metal cruise ship. It's just a wooden sailing vessel. It's hard to imagine. I mean, but I'm sure they were packed on there. And remember, about 100 of those are soldiers. Julius is a centurion, leader of 100 soldiers. Verse 38, "So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea." The last thing they kept on hand here was food. Remember, they already threw over the cargo. They already threw over everything about the ship's rigging that they didn't need. And now, finally, whatever food is left, they throw it overboard. Why? Doesn't that seem crazy to throw food overboard? Yeah, exactly. They need to lighten this ship as much as absolutely possible so that it rides as high on the water as it possibly can. So that when they come up on this island and run aground, they can be as close to the island as they can be when the ship runs aground. So that's the whole plan here. Verse 39. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach, onto which they planned to run the ship, if possible. They had no idea where they were. We know, though, that it was the island of Mileta. Now, according to the scriptures, that's what it was called then, the island of Mileta. Today, what we call it, Malta. And so that's what's reflected on the map up here. They run aground at Malta. They see a beach, though, where a creek empties into it here at the bay, and they determine to run the ship aground there. Again, hoping to ride high enough on the water to get very close to the shore so that they don't have to tread these waters that are in this tempest for very far. Verse 40. And when they let go of the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile, loosing the rudder ropes, they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. They put the sail up so they can run as fast as they can again to try to get as close to the shore as possible. Verse 41. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. That's the front. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. Where two currents met around this island, there was a sand shoal that stretched out into the sea here, out into the water, and the front stuck fast in that shoal. The back end of the ship began to break apart from the waves because the storm is still very, it's a raging storm, still very dangerous. Now, they were anchored earlier. Why didn't the ship break up then when they were anchored? It's still the same storm, but now suddenly the waves beat the back end of the ship so heavily that it begins to break the ship apart.
That boat couldn't move.
Well, it couldn't move so much when it was anchored, but yeah, it could bob up and down, but now it's stuck fast. But another thing is, have you ever noticed the closer you get to the shore, the more violent the waves? When it's out to sea, it's usually just kind of a rolling sea. But then as those waves come up to the coastline, what happens? Yeah, they start to white crest, you know, build up as the water gets shallower. The water being pushed by the wind gets pushed upward higher. And so right at the shoreline, you actually have taller waves. And that's where the ship is now, in this shallower water. And these waves now beat on the ship. You ever gone to the shore and you're standing there and you're not paying a whole lot of attention? Or maybe you are. And then a wave comes up you weren't expecting and bam, knocks you down. Have you ever had that happen? Yeah, I have. So I know many of you have. But if you're a little further out, it's just a rolling wave. Doesn't have that effect on you. So that's what happens here, why the ship now is suddenly breaking apart. So there's no doubt now the ship is going to be broken apart. And they are forced now to abandon ship and swim to shore. Verse 42. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. The Roman soldiers, being Roman soldiers, decide that the best thing to do right now is to kill all the prisoners. You know, we don't want anybody escaping, so let's just kill them all. Say it again. Could be. Sometimes those in charge, you know, they have different ways of going about things. But why so harsh? There you go, Ken. These are Roman soldiers. During this time, if a Roman soldier lost his prisoner, there could be very harsh punishment. Go back to Acts chapter 16 with the Philippian jailer, when there was an earthquake and all the doors were opened and everything, and he then feared all the prisoners had escaped, and what was he going to do? Kill himself. He was going to kill himself. But Paul yelled out to him, "Don't do any harm to yourself. We're all here. That didn't go anywhere." He was afraid of the harsh punishment that he would endure. So here, these Roman soldiers, they don't want that. They don't want a harsh punishment. So if they kill all the prisoners, then none of them can escape. Simple solution, right? If you're a Roman soldier. Verses 43 and 44. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul. Now I want you to stop right there, just for a moment. Without Paul, what would have happened? All the prisoners would have been killed. The centurion would have been on board with that plan. But, wanting to save Paul, he didn't allow that to go through. He kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and go to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. Julius had grown fond of Paul. Didn't want Paul to be killed. And so he decides that everyone should just make way to the shoreline as best as they can, either by swimming or grabbing something to use as a flotation device. And they all make it to shore safe and sound. Exactly as Paul had said would happen by the word of the Lord. Think Paul's going to gain some credibility here? Absolutely. You think God is going to get a little bit of glory here? I hope so. I hope so. Paul is now, through the hand of the Lord, put himself in a position of leadership now. And it's going to grow here before they reach Rome. And that will give Paul an opportunity to witness to these idol worshipers about the true and living God. And how did all that come about? By Paul's prayer. What a challenge for us. So many times we see people as our enemy and we harbor ill will against them. But notice that wasn't Paul's attitude. Paul loved them, reached out to them in love. Paul wanted them to be able to hear the gospel. And God heard that prayer and allowed each and every one of them to survive. And guess what they're going to hear? They're going to hear the gospel now. And Paul now has a position of leadership or respect among them so that hopefully there will be an opportunity for them to believe.